What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardwark. This week, joined by podcast producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. We're going to be talking about Windows today. Last week, Microsoft announced some big plans to sort of reset Windows 11 so it doesn't stink anymore. And some of those plans involves taking a step back from AI, which is kind of interesting. So we've got a special guest on to talk about that. There's also a bunch of other AI news. There's OpenAI killing Sora. We'll discuss what all that means. And some things around social media, too. Big trials around Meta. Them losing in court a few times. We'll talk about all that. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We'd love to get your questions. We'll be answering one at the end of the show as well. And you can join us Thursday mornings around 10:30 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel for our live stream. We'll answer your questions. We'll show off some gadgets when we can. And it's just a fun time. You can also chat with everybody else there. So let's talk about Microsoft's big plan to fix Windows 11. So joining us to talk about that is Mark Hockman from PC World. Hey, Mark, how's it going?
Good. How are you guys?
Doing okay. And kind of shocked by this news, like kind of shocked by this sort of like admitted self-own by Microsoft. So Pavan Davuluri, the head of Windows and devices over there at Microsoft, somebody we've talked to a couple times, actually. We did interview him a couple years ago. And I think that was around the Copilot Plus launch. But he put up a blog post kind of admitting that people are not liking what Microsoft is doing with Copilot and Windows 11 these days. And they announced a series of changes. And those changes are basically things everybody has been yelling at them at for. They're going to be yanking Copilot out of some apps, so it's a bit less in your face. They're going to be giving you more customization control. You'll be able to, once again, move the taskbar along the sides or top of the screen if you want, rather than just the bottom. And there are also some promises around, in general, making Windows Explorer, the File Explorer, far easier to just make it faster, more responsive. They're also saying there are going to be some stability improvements and whatnot. Kind of a shocking thing from a company that's been trying to shove Copilot everywhere over the last few years. So, Mark, what was your impression, you know, based on this news? Like, when you first read it, what is your impression about, like, this potential fix? Do you think it could fix Windows 11? And what do you think about the state of Windows 11 right now?
Two things, really. One, it was long overdue. I mean, this is something that should have happened 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, or it probably should have never happened in the first place. It should have been sort of a continuation, in my mind, from Windows 10. Yeah. And second, I think it's obviously a plus for Microsoft. I mean, when I saw this announcement, I thought to myself, oh, it's just going to be a few talking points. There's not going to be really much of substance here. And there was a list of changes that Microsoft wanted to make, and these changes that the company is planning to make are what people have been asking for a long time. So it's obvious that they have heard and understood what the community has been asking for. It's just they refuse to do it. And I think probably the reason for that is the one that everyone sort of just understands to be what Microsoft has had for, you know, had as its fatal flaw for the last couple of years. And that's just been this overdependence on AI, stuffing Copilot into pretty much everything that Windows offers. And just their acknowledgement that, you know, hey, sticking Copilot into something like a taskbar or into Notepad, for example, is just an overreach, and they need to sort of pull back and offer features that consumers actually want for themselves. The thing that I honestly, and I'll just, you know, just throw this out there right away, because this is, I think, for me, the most important thing is that, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when Microsoft launched Windows 10, it was a real, I don't know if it was a collaborative effort. I'm not going to go that far, but it felt like the opinions of users were valued. I mean, Microsoft had launched its Windows Insider program. They put betas out there. They encouraged people to give them feedback. But they also brought in people, like, they actually had like in-person events where you could go and talk to the developers themselves as they were creating these things. And you could tell, and they could tell you, hey, this is what we thought when we created this feature. And you could say, well, that's a great idea, but what happens if you pursue this route? And, you know, just being able to talk to the person, the product manager, like overseeing like the Photos app, you know, it's almost revolutionary. I mean, it's just something that it felt so, well, I guess welcoming would be the right word, just felt so, again, kind of collaborative. And you know, Windows 11 was sterile. It looked kind of like a Chromebook. I mean, yeah. I don't know if they're going to go back to this approach, but you know, if there's any possibility that they could, I think that would be the kind of thing that I would certainly welcome, both as someone who covers Microsoft and as a user of Windows.
It's probably worth taking a step back to think about like how we got here, right? Because you are talking about that Windows 10 era, which I think was really strong. And Windows 10, it's always with these companies, right? They screw up and then they have to come back being like, we're so sorry. We're going to fix it all. We're going to listen to you. And the screw up before that was Windows 8, right? And nobody liked Windows 8. Windows 8 was a thing where Microsoft was trying to shove the touch experience, like, oh yeah, you're going to treat your Windows PC like a tablet, hybrid tablet Windows devices are totally going to be a thing. You're going to love them all. And to a certain degree, sure, lots of tablets, lots of laptops got touchscreens. They launched the Surface devices, but I don't think anybody really liked Windows 8 because that was like purely style over substance. Windows 10 was going all the way back to like, okay, we know what you guys want. You want the desktop. You don't want this like tablet experience first. You want a real start menu. You want like an operating system that just works the way you expect it on a desktop. And I think overall, Windows 10 was a huge success. And that also came at the time where Satya Nadella was coming on at Microsoft as well and trying to like make his mark. And he was in like boring nerd mode, right? It was all about productivity. It was all about getting work done. It's not like the Apple thing, right? Macs, where it feels like Apple's always trying to deliver a great experience and make you feel good about using your products. Microsoft at that point was about getting work done. And then Copilot happened. And, you know, Satya Nadella got really into AI. And I could sort of feel the ground shifting underneath us. Like, this is some sort of earthquake, and I don't know if it's good. And that started with the Bing Chat event that was, like, in February. And they, like, at the last minute rushed everybody to Seattle to check that out. And it was cool. It was, like, the coolest Bing ever was, I think. But what it symbolized was Microsoft just being so amazed by what this partnership with OpenAI could do. Okay, Bing is all AI now. Now it's Bing Chat. Now it turns into Copilot. Copilot's so great. Let's put Copilot everywhere. A Copilot in Windows, Copilot in Microsoft 365. And I think it's just this thing where they were so enamored with it, even when I would sit down and talk with executives and be like, this Copilot is not giving me right answers, right? It's a very shiny thing, but it is often incorrect. And the responses I got from Microsoft executives were always really weird. They were like, oh yeah, give it time, it would be better. And I'd be like, no, I'm not going to tell my calculator to be better. If I ask you 2 + 2, you got to give me the real answer or I'm going to throw you out. It was this weird thing. Did you get that a similar sense, Mark?
First of all, it's interesting that you bring up the 2 + 2 thing, because at the very end of the days of Cortana, that was one of the stories that I wrote where I asked 2 + 2 and it, of course, got the wrong answer, which was fun.
How many R's are in strawberry or something?
Yeah, that's always the one, right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I would agree with you. I think there's also something that, you know, I think that Microsoft executives were absolutely enamored with AI. I completely agree with you on that. I also think it's a little bit more of a psychological thing. You know, you want to get users, two things that Microsoft wants to do. They want to get users in the habit of using a specific feature, and they want to get users in the habit of paying for a specific feature. Right. So by putting Copilot everywhere, it sort of was saturation bombing. It just basically said, hey, get used to using it. If it delivers the answers you want, get used to paying for it. I think there was obviously issues with putting it everywhere and then delivering the wrong answer, because people didn't see that as something that they wanted to use. It's what they saw it as something they wanted to avoid. And I think even today, most people, when they think of AI, they don't necessarily hit Windows plus C to open the Copilot app. They're opening up a web browser or a specific app to launch Claude or ChatGPT or something of that sort. So Microsoft was first to the market, but I think they unfortunately fumbled the ball, and it left room for other people to sort of take over that habitual usage thing that they were trying to establish.
It's the desperation we see from all these companies too. That also explains like what Meta has been doing, right? Meta, when they saw the metaverse wasn't working, and we'll talk about like the continued failure of all their investments in the metaverse, Zuckerberg was betting like, okay, the metaverse is the next thing. VR is the next thing. We're going to own this because we missed mobile. And also the same thing Microsoft is worried about, and also the same thing a lot of other tech companies are worried about. And now they're like, okay, we're going to be in on AI. We're going to be the AI pioneers. And to be the pioneers, you're going to take some hits. And I also think users don't respond well if you're basically delivering a product they don't really need. I think people kind of inherently felt that. let's talk about some of the changes they say we're going to be seeing in Windows 11. So, yeah, pulling back on Copilot from inessential apps, so stuff like Notepad and Photos. I don't know who was using those things. I think the best thing is being more flexible with Windows updates, because this is something I have noticed. Like, if you have update setting and you want to reboot your computer or turn off your computer, your only option right now is to reboot and install updates, or shut down and install updates. And they're going to give you a little more flexibility about how to do that. I didn't used to think that was a problem, but now that I'm looking at it, like, it does feel like one of those things where Microsoft is really forcing you to do that. And now that they've been delivering these updates that have been unstable over the last few months and the last year, they've been bricking computers. I think there's good reason for people not to want to update immediately. More control over widgets and feeds, more transparency about the Windows Insider program. So you'll be able to see what level of Windows Insider you are. You'll be able to give feedback more easily. These all seem like good things, but it's kind of hilarious to me, Mark. Like, okay, you're going to make Windows work like it used to, essentially. Like, less AI, more core features, make it work a little faster, improve overall performance. They're promising faster, more stability, better driver support, more stable drivers, stuff like that. Nothing new. It's more like, okay, it's going to be like the Windows you remember, right? The Windows at its most stable, which is what? Windows 10, maybe Windows 2000 for the people who remember that.
I mean, there's certainly a blast of nostalgia here because, again, yes, you're absolutely right. Going back to what we all liked about Windows, you know, more collaboration, less, you know, overbearing features and so forth. I thought the interesting thing about the Windows update thing, I think it was interesting because, again, that's a thing that sort of, you know, if you see Windows fails on the internet, it's usually like some newscast and all of a sudden their teleprompter reboots in the middle of it and so forth. I mean, that's the kind of thing that people tend to focus upon when it's when it's Windows errors. For me, you know, it's interesting because for a while there, Windows Update wasn't especially obnoxious. It was just like, there was a few updates every so often. I could just go ahead, oh, okay, there's an update, I'll just schedule it and so forth. There seems like there's updates every day now. And especially, I don't know if you've noticed, those security updates they launched this year, which I think are kind of new in the 26th, so pretty much every month of 26 so far. Mm-hmm. They take a long time to download. They take a long time to install. I mean, they're just. I can understand the reason for them in part because of what you mentioned, you know, updates breaking computers and so forth, but they're just a pain. And I think that, yes, managing those in some fashion will provide a degree of relief for somebody. I also think that it's interesting that the key feature that sort of everyone focused upon, because we sort of had to, and it's the one that sort of people have been asking about, was the taskbar, the movable taskbar. And it's interesting because I actually think that Microsoft just, again, dropped the ball on this, because I really don't think that people, they have telemetry where they can see how many people use their features. And I think with a movable taskbar, really nobody moves the taskbar. They move it once and they sort of fix upon it. That's the way they want it.
But it's the idea that you're not allowed to move it annoys a significant chunk of people, right? So it doesn't really matter if a lot of people do. It's more like just let the nerds who want a top screen or side taskbar do it.
But I saw it as like seat, the ability to, you know, to adjust your seat in your car, for example, because once you have your seat adjusted, you tend to not move it ever again, unless there's a new driver or something of that sort. There, again, with taskbar, I'm sure nobody actually touched it because they put it on the side or the top and left it there. So Microsoft said to itself, well, nobody wants this feature, so let's go ahead and get rid of it, which was, of course, the wrong thing to do. So now I think that maybe if that thesis is true, maybe Microsoft will sort of reevaluate those features and how people use them and think to themselves, oh, well, we were wrong. It's sort of like that metaphor where their World War II airplanes would come back and the ones that came back never had bullet holes like the engines or the cockpit or anything of that sort. Same sort of thing, I think.
It is funny, like every time Microsoft touches like a core aspect of Windows, people freak out, right? And it's easy to forget because nobody really loved Windows 11 when it came, but it had some weird restrictions. The taskbar was only centered, so everything was like nicely centered, like the OS X dock. The button itself, like, yeah, you couldn't push it to the left like so many people are used to. But the thing that annoyed me most is that they turned on by default the automatic grouping of apps. And I will keep harping on this. So when Windows 11 launched, It would be taskbar, and you would see an icon for the app you had open, not the specific window. So if I had like multiple windows of Firefox or Evernote open, you'd have to, okay, I see that in the taskbar. Where are my tasks? I have a 32-inch monitor. I have a tiny bundle of task icons here. Oh, I have to click again. Okay, now I have to right-click to see what window I have open. That's a Mac mess. That's one of the things I hate the most about Mac OS and the dock and everything, is that you don't have a full array of everything you have open. You have to click in. You have to do like a tab click or something else on Macs. And then eventually they were like, okay, we hear you. You can put the taskbar on the left now. Are you happy? And then later on, even quietly, they're like, okay, we hear you. You can ungroup those taskbar icons if you'd like. And I immediately did that. And all of a sudden, it was much more usable because Windows was like Windows 10 again. But the same thing happened when they replaced the taskbar with the start screen, or the start menu with the start screen, Windows 8, right? Everybody freaked out because it was such a change of pace, and it really slowed things down too. I wonder if the lesson Microsoft is learning is like, you have this great core thing. Do not touch that. Make it better. Are we going to call this MWAGA? Make Windows Great Again is kind of what they're going for. And they're making Windows great again by just being boring, which is great. Be boring, be stable. Don't shove all this other stuff in my face if you're going to slow down what I'm actually trying to do. I feel like that's the main takeaway here.
And the funny thing is that I actually stopped, maybe it was around the Windows 8 timeframe, actually using the icons to launch applications. I just hit the Windows key and then start typing it, like, sure. I don't know, Chrome or whatever it might be. It's just because I guess I just got frustrated at the whole thing. I mean, the nice thing about Microsoft is that it does accommodate a variety of users with a variety of modalities. I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of talk in the past couple of weeks about, you know, touchscreens, for example. You know, does anyone care about them? And the answer is probably no. But at the same time, I use them for one specific thing, and that's to like rearrange windows. If I like undock my laptop and things freak out, I just use it. It's just easier to do it. But I never actually use it from then on out. Same sort of thing can apply to various things within the Windows operating system too. I mean, the start menu and so forth. But, you know, but again, yes, it's just the fact that when Microsoft messes with an established method of doing things, within a habit, that's what irritates people. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are extremely effective in DOS, and I know there are people who are extremely effective in Linux because they're simply used to being able to quickly type out or click on what they want to do and nothing changes. But when Microsoft again starts futzing with the way that you do things, yeah, people get irritated.
Got that taskbar thing. I will never let them down. I will never like let them forget what they did there.
Well,
a couple of things.
Yeah. Stardock made a whole business out of it. Yeah. I mean, they've been existing for years on Start 7 and various other defenses and so forth because of Microsoft's inability to change.
Stardock and window blinds. Those were the days. A couple of things I should mention here. This announcement comes a couple weeks after the MacBook Neo launched. And let me tell you, I reviewed that thing. I'm like, how is this a $600 computer? What the hell are you doing, PC manufacturers? What the hell are you doing, Microsoft, that you can't make an OS that can actually still run on 8 gigabytes of RAM? There, it feels like there's some like dark magic going on in the MacBook Neo. And what a time for Apple to release that. I'm just like gushing over this thing. I don't know if you spent time with it, but does this announcement feel like Microsoft saying, hey guys, we see what you're saying, and we're going to make Windows better. We promise. Please don't buy a MacBook Neo. Please. That's kind of what it feels like to me.
Yeah, I thought that there was a little bit of that to me as well. I despise Macs, so I'm not going to use. Same with iPhones. I just refuse to use anything with Apple.
You should at least touch the MacBook Neo.
There's a reason for that, which is personal, which is basically that iPhones use the whole green bubble, blue bubble thing. My kid didn't have one during the pandemic. He got really stressed out and about the whole thing. And so I was just like, hey, man, you know, you made my kid cry. Forget it. I'm not going to use it.
Yeah, it's unnecessary. I will say, though, get your fingers on the MacBook Neo and just take a second to be like, what the hell are you doing? Dell and Asus and everybody else. Like, this thing is $600.
Well, the thing of it is that they own the silicon, they own the operating system, the integration between the two is so solid. The one thing that you'll notice with the Mac silicon is that, and my, I don't know if this is still my pet theory, and Microsoft's kind of shot it down, but I still think it's partially true at least. But I mean, the single core performance on the Mac silicon far outpaces anything that the x86 or even Qualcomm can throw at it right now. And usually single core performance, single thread performance is intrinsically tied to the operating system. And so I think that that Apple sort of understands, okay, fast performance plus you know, a deeply integrated operating system just gives you a snappy experience, and snappy experiences resonate with consumers. So I think maybe a lot of what Microsoft has done with like 26H1, for example, where they're really trying to get Windows on ARM up to speed, might have some of that in the background. Like, hey, you know, my Apple's great on ARM. We can do the same thing, but you know, it's just taking a while.
The Windows on ARM thing, again, also feels like a response to Apple, and that they've made great strides with that. The Snapdragon hardware of the last few years have been great. But it's the Apple single core performance, like you're saying. Apple has had the they've had the single fastest core for the last few years since the M series chips launched. That's been their claim to fame. But also that integrated memory, which is something, you know, we only saw in GPUs before the M series chips, like having the RAMs right there, the CPU cores are right there. The responsiveness between them is like insanely fast. That's something that you cannot easily replicate with like a normal x86 chip. And I think that leads to the snappiness as well. Like I loaded up that MacBook Neo with tabs, dozens of tabs, 4K video, tons of things. And like it had a big ass page file. The page file was like 16 gigabytes, but it didn't slow down. It still like kept kicking with 8 gigabytes of RAM. And that kind of made me just look at things in a different way. I know you're going to have to go soon, Mark.
Some of the stress tests for the MacBook Neo I've seen are incredible. Someone scrubbing through 4K footage. I'm not sure if I'm confabulating two different videos, but the thing that I remember is 4K footage, like five tabs of Dune 2 playing all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then on a separate window, they're also playing Sims 4.
That's memory management, baby. If you've got fast page files and fast access between the disk and the RAM and everything, like you will not feel that thing here. You won't feel that slowdown. I do have to ask you, Mark, like also how much of this response feels like Microsoft prepping us for like, hey, we also know Xbox is down and the future of Xbox is unfortunately Windows, and we got to prepare Windows to be better as an Xbox thing too, because Microsoft is just taking it on all sides at this point, right? Like the gaming side, hell, complete hell. The PC side, like, okay, they've got a certain amount of dominance, but also these chips from Apple are killing it. The Mac, but Neo is just like whopping everything on the PC side. It does feel like they got to make Windows better so that in the future they can create this sort of like Xbox console experience that's at least based on Windows. There's a lot of refinement they've been avoiding, I think, for the last few years.
I think there's some cultural shifts coming in Xbox, which they're not willing to talk about quite yet. And for those of us who I've chatted with them a little bit, and I don't have enough to publish anything on it, but I mean, I think they're trying to shift the culture around the sort of the console experience and bring that a little bit more into the PC space. And we've seen that, of course, with the Xbox app and things like that. But I don't know. I mean, it's to this day, I still am an Xbox fan. I know a lot of people have shifted over to the PS5. I think they're doing a lot of interesting things. I think Game Pass is still a success. I think it's marvelous. I mean, maybe the publishers don't like it, but I mean, it saves me tons of money and it gives me exposure to things like that. So, I think there's still a story to be told on the Xbox side of things. And I think that that's going to be being told by some of the leadership as it comes out. But we've got a couple of years to make that to get those things explained as well, though.
Yeah, like the one thing they have total leadership on is PC gaming. So it's like, why aren't you doubling down on that? You know, why aren't you? To me, the Xbox Series X and S, they should have tried to do this back then. They should have been like, wow, we totally screwed up the Xbox One. Sony really owns this idea of a high-end piece of hardware that is purely a console. What do we do? What do we have? We have Windows. We have an open PC platform. We have people who already have tons of games on other platforms. Maybe we should just make it easier to like have that PC-like experience on your TV. And this gets us back to web TV and all those failed things. But my goodness, I just reviewed a Falcon Northwest, the Frag Box, that like little mini desktop thing. I was reviewing it on my home theater. I'm like, this is exactly the same as it was 20 years ago when I connected Windows to my TV. All the same issues, all the same like resolution fighting, all the same like, okay, I gotta make sure I have a keyboard handy to jump in and do things. It's still a miserable experience, and I don't know how they just missed out so far. Anyway, folks, there's a lot of stuff going on here. Let us know what you think. Do you think these changes will help Windows 11? Will you be sticking with Windows? And how much more tempting is the MacBook Neo now as we see Microsoft flounder around all this? Let us know. podcastengadget.com. Mark, where can people find you these days online?
I am at PCWorld.com, of course, and you can find me mostly on Blue Sky under my name and on Twitter, unfortunately. I have to maintain a presence there, which, of course, we don't necessarily want to be there, but that's okay. So, yeah, just it's an easy search. Just hit Mark Hockman social media and you'll find me.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
All right, let's move on to the other big news of the week. OpenAI, surprisingly, is shutting down its Sora video generation app. And I feel like both these things are like people reassessing the value of AI. Although in Sora's case, it probably wasn't the fact that people were just purely hating on it. This thing was likely very hard, very expensive to produce. There were metrics showing that people were not using the app and it likely wasn't making much money. So this thing is dead. And also that deal OpenAI made with Disney to partner
$1 billion.
$1 billion. That deal is also dead. And from what I'm hearing, Disney was shocked. Like Disney had no prior knowledge that this $1 billion deal that they had signed with this young tech company was apparently completely dead, because they didn't know that OpenAI was shutting this thing down. So kind of goes to show like the sort of instability of this company. We've mentioned this before of how they just kind of do things. They have no real strategy. What we're saying, the quote here is, "We've decided to continue Sora in the consumer app and API as we focus and compute demand grows. The Sora research team continues to focus on world simulation research to advance robotics that will help solve real-world physical tasks." So, okay, instead of fake AI videos, this team will be working on the robot brain stuff. And hopefully it's going to not destroy us all. I feel like...
The entire idea was that maybe by generating video, you would also get a little closer to AGI. But, like, there are people who say that, like, LLM-based methods toward AGI are just a dead end to begin with.
I think a lot of people say that too. And
A lot of researchers. And this was some of the most interesting chapters of Empire of AI. Mm-hmm. To me, there are several different schools of how to go about AI. And it seems that LLMs just got popular because the Transformer model had a step forward and everybody was like, okay, well, maybe we could, you know, find the promised land through this one.
It is funny. I feel like I've said this before, but it feels like the entire tech industry can be explained with two words. It's sort of like that scene from The Wire where they just say the F word everywhere going over the crime scene. But the two words are, oh, shit. Oh, shit, look what the Transformer model can do. And Google's like, oh, shit, look what OpenAI did. And Microsoft's like, oh, shit, it made Bing so much better. Oh, shit, let's get this in Copilot. Oh, shit, we'll be the best. And it's like, that's it. That's everybody. You can hear everybody muttering that in their heads. And Sam Altman's like, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit, AGI. It's going to happen. The Anthropic guys are like, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit. It's that all the way down. It's that desperation that we've got the shiny new thing that they can use to lord over the technology world. That's ultimately it.
Again, if you think about OpenAI and Sam Altman as being a generationally talented storyteller, as Karen Howe describes him, it's possible Sam Altman saw all of the effective altruist, rationalist folks, like folks that are spent a lot of time thinking about AI to begin with, and saw that they were, you know, very afraid of the possibility of, you know, malevolent AGI. And he's like, actually, this is a fantastic marketing scheme here, because we have our evangelists that are all turnkey. And they also, they're very interested in working in safety. So let's just like bring them. I don't know. That would be very, very well thought out and devious, but hard to say.
Go read Empire of AI, everybody. And also, I don't know if that Sundance documentary I wrote about, Ghost in the Machine, that was the one that drew like the direct line between the sort of like eugenics inherent in Silicon Valley and a lot of the tech world and honestly in mathematics.
Tamit Gebru has talked a lot about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that is pretty much it. I think that makes a strong case. I'll talk about the AI doc, which is another AI documentary later in this episode. But these folks are not like some geniuses out there. These are people responding to market pressures and sort of like surprise advancements that they've kind of stumbled into. Sam Altman is not an AI genius. Sam Altman is not a genius programmer. These things just happen. The same with Zuckerberg. And we see them fail. We see them stumble. And occasionally they have some big hits. And we see the entire industry kind of building around that. So Sora's dead.
Speaking of Zuck, and while we're talking about like layoffs and cuts, Meta also did several hundred layoffs at Reality Labs and four other divisions. This is much less than we were expecting. And I mean, other layoffs at Meta could be coming. Like, we don't know, and maybe they don't know, but it seems like they're trying to shuffle things around, and like right now, VR and AR is on the back burner because they just spent so much money on a bunch of different acquisitions related to AI. So they have to focus on that and make cuts elsewhere. But also, I don't know, they hire a lot of people really quickly for, you know, this one big project. And then who's actually showing up and who's actually interested in working, you know?
Remember those two words, folks. Like, when you can see when these companies are going like, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit. Like, what is happening over here? And the Reality Labs layoffs, which are unfortunate, but also directly tied to Zuckerberg's metaverse ambitions, which nobody wanted. I don't know if any of you spent time in...
Let's not forget that they almost completely pulled the plug on Horizon Worlds and then didn't.
For now, they're saying they didn't. I think they're going to... It's more like, oh, we're not going to publicly kill this baby. We're going to... It's here. It's alive. You can still do stuff, but they will quietly kill it in VR eventually. But also, what was Horizon Worlds? It was an ugly ghost town for like corporate... activations. That's all it was. I did a Target activation in Horizon Worlds. I think for Halloween, it was one of the grimmest things I've ever seen online. It is sort of like there's the wonderfully anarchic vision of the internet of people coming together and using this technology to, you know, form human bonds and relationships. And you can see that in VR chat, which is a cross-platform VR tool that is very much like Second Life, except you can be in VR, talk with normal people, like have like, a, that's a real metaverse, which is a step above something like Fortnite or what's the other stuff? Like the stuff kids.
I mean, Neil Stephenson recently said like Meta's glasses are creepy. And that's the guy who literally came up with the term the metaverse.
I'm pretty sure still Neil Stephenson would totally know that. Like, and it's good to call that out. But
well, I mean, on top of the fact that in Snow Crash, there is a subclass of people called gargoyles that are just live streaming all the time, and nobody wants to talk to them because they're weirdos.
Hey, all of this has happened before and will happen again. This has all been predicted, but...
You could make a connection between that and like the guy who tried to come up to Clavicular. I hate that I just mentioned Clavicular, but like, and they had like Meta glasses on. And so like somebody in like the Looks Maxers posse tried to show the ISIS flag to the Meta glasses because they heard a rumor that that would just like immediately get your account deleted, but it didn't. But like, the structure of that, just the beats of that story, feel so Snow Crash.
The beats of our reality right now are purely Snow Crash and Neil Stephenson. But anyway, remember when people tell you Mark Zuckerberg is a smart person, he is the person who single-handedly renamed his computer after his company, after the metaverse, wasted $80 billion trying to expand to the metaverse and also virtual reality in general. These people are just out there trying to dominate new arenas. That's the only reason he invested in all this stuff. So this is all sad. This is hilarious. And now he's doing it for AI. Let's see what layoffs these lead to. What else is going on with Meta, Ben?
Hoo boy. Okay. So I posted on Blue Sky earlier this week a live look at what's happening with Meta. And it was just like a cartoon fight, like, you know, arms and legs coming out of a dust cloud, because Meta has been getting kicked in the teeth. On 3/24, just earlier this week, what was that, Monday or Tuesday? Meta was ordered to pay $375 million in a New Mexico trial over child exploitation. These are two cases that we have talked about a bit. We just didn't know that the verdicts were going to come in so soon. So after deliberating for less than a day, a New Mexico jury on Tuesday found that Meta Platforms violated state law in a lawsuit brought by the state attorney general, who accused the company of misleading users about the safety of Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp for enabling child sexual exploitation on their platforms. This grew out of a undercover operation mm-hmm. where a former prosecutor ran basically like a honeypot situation. They put up some Instagram accounts and tried to see if people sent creepy DMs. And oh boy, did they send creepy DMs. You can say that some of this is just like human nature and, you know, society being terrible. Absolutely. The important thing here is that you're getting kids on their phones in a relatively like private communication channel versus, I don't know, like, I hear a lot of stories of like women who were waitresses mm-hmm. like before they turned 18 and after they turned 18. And they said that like there is a marked difference between the way people acted toward them, you know, when they were in high school versus when they were in college, which is weird on its own right. But that's in public. Mm-hmm. Like you can't get somebody alone that way. You also can't just like send them a picture of your anatomy, you know?
Mm-hmm. This whole case, by the way, is a reminder of like, hey, people have been talking about this. Like, you have had lax controls, basically protecting minors. And Meta, as it was Facebook, spent a lot of time arguing that, hey, Instagram is not really hurting people, even though it had its own studies, right? That Instagram did affect girls specifically, but teenage users were often adversely affected by these things. These people are out here just trying to gain users at the cost of like the safety of these services. That's all it is.
And here's an interesting way of looking at it. You know, Zuck had a big rightward shift. I think he sensed where the winds were blowing. You saw him wakeboarding with the American flag in 2024 sure, or so. Sure. You know, that was part of his like cool guy rebrand. I don't care. Like I have stopped that apologizing.
I won't apologize anymore thing, which gave him that was his new look, right? Pro man.
But
yeah.
Overall, like just a rightward shift. You know who cares a lot about child welfare? You know who was packing into movie theaters to see The Sound of Freedom?
I don't know.
Wow. Yeah, that really doesn't like track with your new political tack.
I think there are people who say things and then you don't always see those beliefs reflected in who they actually vote for. So I don't know.
Absolutely. Don't know. But yeah. If you're going to be courting a certain like political bent, you should at least know what they're like, what they really care about. No, especially what like the rank and file of folks.
Going a step beyond the self-interest that is driving Zuckerberg and a lot of these people. They don't care.
No, that would be another level of self-interest though, because if you're looking to, you know, get air support, political air support for your projects, you would think that you would go in that direction, at least like make more than cursory like statements in that direction. Jeff Horowitz, a Reuters reporter, said that there were two separate findings of liability in like 37,500 violations. So that's like roughly 74,000 violations with a maximum fine of $5,000. That means that it's $375 million in a state that contains 0.62% of the U.S. population. He's kind of implying that if this were applied to the entire country, that would be a hell of a ruling.
It would be a hell of a ruling. And it'll be interesting to see like what this all leads to. And there's also the social media addiction trial, where we also saw a result this week, too. Yeah.
Yes. So flashback, this was the case in which Zuck testified that he wanted Instagram to be useful, not addictive. The plaintiff was awarded six... So after like 8 days of deliberation, it took a longer time for everybody to figure out whether or not Facebook and or Meta and Google were liable, because this was mostly about Instagram and YouTube. After 8 days, they figured, yes, both companies are liable. Initially, Snapchat and TikTok were also part of the suit, but they settled out of court. Meta and Google were fined $6 million, but Meta is liable for paying 70% of this ruling. YouTube released a statement saying that they disagree on the grounds that they are a streamer, not a social media platform. What's YouTube Shorts then? TikTok, basically. Like, that is a social media platform. From Bobby Allen's NPR story, he said that the outcome of this case could influence thousands of other consolidated cases against social media companies. The litigation has drawn comparisons to the legal crusade that led to industry changes in big tobacco in the 1990s. Why are they being compared to
big? I mean, it's the big thing is to avoid Section 230. So,
well, I mean, okay, but it's Section 230 and it's also product liability.
Well, this is what I'm saying. You avoid the trying to get into the trap of like trying to justify like how much they're responsible for the products that or how much they're responsible for what people are posting, and just to argue it is a defect of the product. You knew this product was defective. You're selling it out there to people, and that is the comparison to big tobacco, and it seems like it's a good strategy. Because I think we have talked about this many times on the show. We've seen many, many examples of Meta being aware from its own internal documents that teens can't switch off of Instagram. They called Instagram a drug. They said all social media platforms are like pushers. Like, they're well aware. They're not idiots over here. But legally, they're trying to argue that they didn't know enough for this to be a problem or that they're not liable for it. We'll see.
Well, I mean, and there's also a question of like whether or not the product was designed to be addictive from the get-go. You know, like Philip Morris might have their own terminology for whether or not cigarettes are addictive, but like tech companies very openly talk about wanting to maximize user minutes and like daily active users. Like, if you were to boil that down, what does that mean other than trying to maximize for addictiveness, you know?
It's, I think it's impossible to argue that that's not what they were aiming for. If you look at social media companies, if you look at any VC-backed tech company, like, that's what it is. That's what VCs want to see. They want to see exponential growth. To achieve that, you need to maximize your engagement with the users. That's why you see garbage ads on a lot of websites. That's why you see lots of weird tricks to get you to sign up for things, or like all these little tricks. I think that was it, the infinite feed of Instagram, like, which became kind of a thing. That's one of those. For TikTok, I think it's the fact that you can switch so easily between videos, and also just like the algorithm is working to like deliver things you want. We've built this. We built this society, and these companies
Like, TikTok videos are like Pringles. Once you pop, you just can't stop.
These companies were infinitely rewarded for chasing this, and now we're seeing like a modicum, a little bit of consequences here. So it'll be really interesting to see like what happens after this. Yeah.
So there's an interesting conversation happening in the chat right now. DeepPro9 says, YouTube is just interactive television. Let's sue television now. Meanwhile, Tom Rogers says, it's the algorithm that they refuse to disclose how it works. TV is not broadcast by an algorithm.
TV is also heavily regulated. I want to point this out. DeepPro9, I love your contributions, but I do wonder when you're going to get tired of carrying water for the tech companies, because I see the chats. I see what's going on here. It's like, oh, buddy, come on. That's it. These big differences are television. Television is regulated by the FCC. What happens on TV is so highly regulated, and all these tech companies are just working in ways that our government is not prepared to directly control. And they're working much faster, too. So it's a shame. That's basically the big difference of what's happening here.
Yeah. Yeah. So between these two rulings, like, Meta had a really bad time this week. And I think this spills over once again, going back to OpenAI, because I just saw a headline right before we started recording saying that OpenAI is putting their plans for erotic chatbots on hold indefinitely.
Now that's a Neal Stephenson headline. Our plans for erotic chatbots, probably not a good idea for reasons that are blatantly obvious to everybody except us, apparently.
There was a quote in this Financial Times article that said, AI shouldn't replace your friends or your family. You should have human connections, says one former OpenAI senior employee who said that they left the company as part of that issue. Then there's also a question of like whether or not ChatGPT would have remained allowed on like Apple's App Store if it became known as the on-demand sext app, you know? Like, investors were freaked out about this. I saw a post online that said, like, I hate hyper-niche Halloween costumes. What do you mean, your sexy suicide coach? That is largely what LLMs have gotten to be known as in the last 6 months, if you've been paying attention to the news.
It's all so stupid. Like, if you want to look at, like, the history of OpenAI's news over the last, like, couple of years, it's just, like, it's wild stuff. Like, how is this a real company? How is this not just, like, a thing propped up by VC money and the wishes and dreams?
I mean, it absolutely is.
That's what it is.
And that's
why
the VCs were freaked out about the possibility of, like, going for something that incredibly addictive.
But it's also propped up by the wishes, the hopes and dreams of Silicon Valley, the people who are so religiously devoted to the idea of AI and AGI, too. Like, that is a big part of it. It sounds weird. It sounds like I'm being hyperbolic. I am not. There are a lot of people who are talking about this, too. So that's the weird thing. We live in a world where people also have these, like, wild beliefs driving their behaviors, and it's affecting reality. It's a damn shame. So anyway, add that headline to the list of OpenAI crazy things.
I mean, one more thing to close the loop. Let's also remember that the XAI spicy mode lawsuit just got started. So, like, there were two bad rulings for Meta, and, like, Elon Musk fucking, like, let's put teenagers in bikinis or something mode in Grok is about to go up in court. So
there's that. They haven't even touched the CSAM
it's
generation.
It's bad, guys.
They haven't touched Grok's CSAM generation yet. So things are just real, real bad out here. But this is, it's a funny week of AI related news, honestly. It's just like failure after failure. And this industry is just like not quite ready to grow up and be a real boy. That's kind of what it seems like. Real quick, we're going to run through some other news here because we've got a bunch of things. Somebody released the iOS 18 Dark Sword exploit on GitHub. This is the exploit that can hack millions of iPhones if you're not fully updated. This is a pretty serious one because it seems like it gave people direct control over iPhones. Update your shit. This is a big reason why when you see security updates, if you hear about stuff like this in the news, update your devices as quickly as you can. You're probably not vulnerable. Like, you're probably not a main target, but also, it is very easy for somebody to get hit with unsecure hardware. It's very easy to lose money. It's very easy for these things to hurt you, you know.
You're probably not a target unless you're living in Ukraine, because this was found on, like, a lot of Ukrainian phones. But, like, that would make sense because the entirety of Ukraine is just, like, a target for, like, Russian cyber operations.
For sure, for sure. But these things are usually created for one purpose, and then once they're out in the wild, like they are now,
yep.
You can do whatever. Then it's a great way to just steal money from people. If you have iOS 18.4 through 18.7, you should update right away. Lots of sad news going around this week, too. Epic is laying off more than 1,000 workers, citing a downturn in Fortnite engagement. Fortnite, by the way, a successful metaverse. A totally successful metaverse, but also, they also cannot avoid the specter of layoffs. They can't avoid, like, economic downturn, unfortunately. I have no other feelings about that other than it's terribly sad. It doesn't really say anything about Fortnite. What it does say is that these companies, especially the big gaming developers, even if you have one of the most successful products in the world, doesn't matter. Doesn't really matter, right? If there is a slight downturn,
upkeep
down
for live service games is really difficult. People are constantly demanding new things, and you need quick reaction teams to consistently update things. But if people get even a little bit less interested in Fortnite and a little more interested in something like Ark Raiders, then all of a sudden you can't pay your mortgage, or Epic, former Epic employees can't pay their mortgage. It's crazy.
It's just awful. This comes after Epic laid off 830 employees in 2023. That was 16% of its workforce at the time. This is a big chunk of people. It's just terribly sad. We're going to see this too. Like, there have been mass layoffs throughout a lot of tech companies, but it's only going to get worse too. Like, as we face rising energy costs and a lot of bad things happening as a result of the stupidity in the world right now. So sit tight, folks. It's not going to be a great time. Honda and Sony also killed the Afila EV. Nope. Shocking nobody, by the way. This was Honda and Sony's, the Sony Honda Mobility joint venture. They showed off this like really tech focused EV several years ago. Since like 2022, I believe it was a dumb idea from the beginning, because Sony doesn't know what it's like to build a car, and Honda is not a great great company when it comes to integrating the brand, the latest new tech in anything. And I think the story we're seeing right now from Tim Stevens, who used to be in Gadgets Editor-in-Chief and is now writing a lot of car-related stuff for us. Tim Stevens says the Aphelia 1 came too late and now it is gone too soon. RIP to the PlayStation car. It was an interesting idea when it was initially announced, but EVs have evolved so quickly over the last few years that this thing feels ancient, and they were going to try to sell this as like a premium EV in the era where... even Tesla is like having a hard time, where there's so much EV competition and you can get a great EV for under $50,000 now. This thing just never made any sense. So I'm not surprised this died. And this is also Honda killed some of their EV concepts too a couple of weeks ago. So that's a real shame. That's a real shame. Nobody will miss this thing, but it's really weird how Honda and Toyota are totally like screwing up in the EV world. Do you want to talk about the Elon Musk thing, Ben, misleading investors during his Twitter takeover?
Yeah, it was basically like, remember in, was it like 2022 now? When Elon Musk said, I'll buy Twitter. No, actually, I won't buy Twitter.
Too many bots.
There are too many bots. Like, I don't think I want to buy Twitter. There are people who are saying, hey, you messed around with the stock price. If you intentionally mess around with the stock price, that's securities fraud. It went to court, and it was actually deemed to be securities fraud. Because if you are coming in as one of the richest people in the world, and you say that you have financing from a whole bunch of different people, including Saudi Arabia, they're always coming up recently. That is like a real credible thing that would get people in the markets excited. But then if you play around with it, if you just say, oh, actually, you know, maybe I don't want to, or like he was almost walked out on the deal at one point.
Yeah. I mean, it's
you could credibly say that he was messing with the stock price and maybe trying to get a better price for the eventual purchase.
It also seemed like the whole deal almost seemed like the result of a drug trip or something to you. Like the result of like, oh, he had this crazy idea and like people are postulating, is he coming down right now as he's realizing the magnitude of what he's done? And
this is also kind of connected to the thing from years ago before the pandemic when he said that he had funding secured to take Tesla private when stock price hit 420. Like, there was a time when the SEC actually said, we need someone to babysit you when you were on Twitter. Remember that?
I do remember that. Hey, talk about everything is securities fraud. Elon Musk is walking securities fraud. That's kind of where we are.
Well, I mean, yeah, when people say that everything is securities fraud, it's usually like, you know, again, if we use the case of Elon Musk, if Elon Musk said something about like the fact that he didn't disclose like a health issue or something, and the fact that like the value of so many of his companies is tied up in everybody being interested in Elon Musk, the person, then there would be an idea of like, oh, well, you didn't disclose this. This was securities fraud. I'm going to bring a lawsuit against you. That is, you know, kind of squishy. And the idea of like everything is securities fraud in big quotes. But it seemed like Elon Musk did actual securities fraud here.
He's done it multiple times. Will he face any consequences? We will wait to see.
We should say that there have been appeals on all of these court cases, of course. So we'll see how much actually ends up being paid out of the $375 million and the $6 million and possible billions that Musk could have to pay for this securities case.
All right, let's round out the rest of the news this week. ARM has released its first in-house chip. Meta is its debut consumer. It's an AGI CPU. That's what they're calling it anyway, because it's built for running AI inferencing in data centers. This is not really a consumer chip. This is just ARM building its own thing. It is wild, though, because ARM is a chip design company. So ARM has been, you know, basically licensing its chip architecture to Apple, Amazon, Google, NVIDIA, everybody. When you hear about ARM chips, it's because somebody is taking their designs and then proceeding to add stuff to it and then get it manufactured. So that is kind of wild. Also reminds me that NVIDIA tried to buy ARM several years ago, and the British regulators did not allow it. And thank goodness. Thank goodness.
Yeah, that was really smart of them.
NVIDIA already was one of the biggest AI companies in the world, and certainly one of the biggest chip companies in the world. That's where regulators stepped in and was like, we cannot let you have control of all of this stuff, like this baseline architecture of so much of the world right now. So yeah, ARM is still its own thing, and now they're building their own chips, and this is going to be interesting moving forward. Perhaps even more interesting, because we heard like Microsoft is trying to design its own thing and all the other companies. This is going to be interesting, because ARM actually knows what they can do with their hardware. So we'll keep an eye on that stuff. All right, let's get to some listener mail. As I promised, Brandon from San Luis Obispo says, they're a casual photographer looking to jump into professional work, and the next logical step is getting a good display and the correct hardware for it. They're really interested in the M4 and M4 Pro Mac Mini. They're not going to be doing much video editing, but maybe on occasion, it's mostly intense photo editing. Is it worth waiting for the Mac Mini M5 or go on for the M4 or M4 Pro right now? And also, do we have any recommendations for color-accurate monitors under $500? I will say I don't have an immediate monitor in mind for this one, so you've got a lot of options out there. Definitely, if you are thinking about getting a Mac Mini, if you can hold off like 3 or 4 months, I think you will be pleased, because right now, Apple just updated all of its hardware, except for the iMac, I believe, and the Mac Mini, to the M5 chips. And I think like the rumors are pointing to something maybe around June or July, maybe more likely around June when we'll see that new hardware. Also, Apple, I think, has been having trouble keeping the Mac Mini in stock because a lot of people have been buying them to be little AI machines. Like people have been using them to run their own local AI models and just doing all sorts of stuff. I love the Mac Minis quite a bit. And if you need to get one right away, like, yeah, sure, the M4 Pro or M4 will be totally fine. And honestly, like, Apple, like, these things last a long time. Even if you're doing it professionally, if you get a used M3, was there an M3 Mac Mini? If you get a used older Mac Mini, as long as it has the M series chip, it'll still be pretty great for professional work. Probably wouldn't do the M1 right now. That one's getting a little old, but the M2 to M3 are still like fantastic things. You can get some good deals used. Sit tight if you want a brand new one. And yeah, let us know, folks. Like, do you all have any recommendations for color accurate monitors under $500? I want to know what the actual pros are using. I have to do more research on that one personally.
I also don't know whether or not you could find like a really good color accurate monitor under $500.
It depends on the size.
Well, yeah, you don't want a teeny little thing too, though.
I'm thinking like 27 inches is the baseline that a lot of people are going for, but some people are totally fine with 24-inch monitors. Personally, I think if you're doing a desktop type thing, like you want at least 27 inches. When you go much bigger, that's where it costs a lot more, but you could probably get a decent one for under $1,000 at 27 inches. I'm not sure how close to 500 you'll get it. All right, let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. Do you have anything, Ben, you want to shout out?
I actually don't. And this is a sign for me that I need to like take in more new information per week so I have something to talk about, because I've just been listening to podcasts and listening to like really thick, kind of densely written nonfiction books and playing Ball X Pit. And I mean, it's not really pop culture, but like, hey guys, did you know that if you have too many cool, like big vinyl stickers, that you can just get like magnets cut around the vinyl sticker and now your sticker is a magnet? That's what I've been doing, but that's not really pop culture. So Dev, tell us about what you've been watching.
You're just living that random like creative things that Brooklyn hipsters do. Like you're just living that life.
Yeah.
That's great. Love it. I do want to shout out, I mentioned this before, the AI doc, or How I Became an Apocalypse Optimist. I saw this movie a couple of weeks ago. I'll be writing a review for Engadget. It's directed by Daniel Roer and Charlie Tyrell. Daniel Roer won a documentary for his documentary, or won an Oscar for his documentary, Navalny. So this is a guy who is like well-known in the world of documentaries. This is an interesting film. I wouldn't say it's particularly revolutionary to me, but it's because I'm in this news. I'm following the AI industry and everything. So this is a movie made for normal people who are maybe not aware.
Yeah, there was a question in the chat asking if the AI doc was something that would uncover some new information if they're the sort of person who listens to this show.
I think it's worth watching. it is worth watching because you get to hear some of these people, including Dario Amodè, and you get people on the pro AI side, you have people on the AI critic side just speaking to the camera and trying to answer the questions that Daniel Rohrer is posing. And the real like framing of this is that he is expecting his first child. And he's thinking, like, what world am I bringing my kid into? Because these pro AI people say it's going to be pure utopia. These doom and gloom people say it's the end of civilization. This feels pretty bad as an expecting parent. So he's trying to navigate that whole thing while also trying to get a sense of, like, what is AI? What does all this mean? I think it's a really well-produced documentary, maybe a little over-directed at times. It's one of those movies that can never, like, just let a moment linger. There's always, like, a little animation, a little something, like, just active, trying to move and make you interested in what's going on here. I think the conversations are fine. He did get a lot of people here. Like, he got Sam Altman for a bit. Mark Zuckerberg never replied, I believe, to their thing, to their request. And then it was Elon Musk said he would like be interviewed for it, but never showed up to his interview, apparently. So like, it's funny, like, who is here? And you get to hear these people just, like, say the wildest things, you know?
I mean, they also got, like, Yudkowsky, which is, mm-hmm. you know, kind of a big get, but also, like, he literally wrote a book called If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies.
Yes. And you've got extremists like them, which are maybe, like, maybe just chill out, buddy. Like, maybe you have also no one founding to predict the total doom and catastrophe. But there's a lot of good researchers and a lot of, like, good commentary here. I would say it is worth watching for everybody. It is mostly meant for people who have not been following this all super closely, because it just kind of lays out the framework of where we are in the AI world and what we're worried about. And the whole idea, you know, it's not a spoiler, but like, it's in the title, How I Became an Apocaloptimist, is this idea of trying to confront a world that you will likely know will be very bad. But maybe we can try to make it better if we work together and use our voices and critique these things as they're happening and don't let AI be the inevitability that a lot of these companies say it will be. So you have the power, humans. That's it. Like, speak up around this stuff. I don't think Microsoft would be pulling back on Copilot if people didn't keep telling them what dog shit it was, you know? And this keeps happening. So keep up. Keep shouting, folks, because I think it does make a difference. This movie is worth watching. I'd say even if you're following the news, it just won't be as revolutionary, I think, for a lot of folks. That other one I talked about, Ghost in the Machine, I don't know if that has distribution yet, but that's kind of interesting because I don't think people are fully aware of the sort of like easy line you could draw from eugenics to where we are now, to the accelerationists, to these people building a thing that they assume will be smarter than humans and will make life better for humans. The question is, make life better for who? And that's not something the AI doc answers very much. I wish I had more time to do that, to talk about, like, all these AI proponents say it's going to make the world better, but they're not really saying who that's for and what will happen to everybody else. I feel like it could have been a little more critical there. But it is like worth a watch.
I mean, any time when you start talking mm-hmm. about intelligence and like mm-hmm. how to measure intelligence and who and what is intelligent, you get really muddy really quickly.
Anyway, check out the AI doc if you'd like in theaters this weekend, or it's probably going to be streaming soon, like within a couple weeks or something. So it is worth watching. I just wish it pushed a little harder. We are trying to get an interview with Daniel Rohrer on this podcast, so we will see if that's going to happen over the next few weeks. So stay tuned for that.
That's it for the episode. Thanks so much for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra and Blue Sky, and a podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
Post literally any like recommendation for good media, because obviously I need to see more things. You can send that to me at Hey Bellman on Blue Sky. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.